Hi, I'm Lainey, host of the True Crime Fan Club podcast, and I'm excited to tell you about my brand new podcast called It's Haunted, What Now? It's a podcast that brings you true stories about haunted objects and the owners who unknowingly welcome them into their lives. Join me as I share these creepy, spooky, and downright terrifying stories. You can find It's Haunted, What Now? On your favorite podcatcher or at hauntedpod.com.
What's your emergency?
Every 60 seconds, a person is murdered somewhere in the world.
There was a shootout in my house. I can't believe it.
What causes ordinary people to do unthinkable things?
He stabbed me in my neck. And he says, look how easily I could kill you.
The Minds of Madness is a true crime podcast that examines the most disturbing criminal minds. We shed a light on the devastating impact these violent crimes have on the victims and their families.
When you get calls in the night, you know they're not good or they're wrong numbers.
You'll hear about the incredible strength of the survivors and what they did to fight back.
I was studying his face because I was thinking, if I get out of this, I'm going to get you someday.
Subscribe to the Minds of Madness podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. On June 6th, 1966, a man named Anton LaVey created the Church of Satan. It was a time of radical upheaval in American culture, and LaVey rode that wave successfully in establishing his new church. Though this religion is more about hedonistic freedom than actual devil worship, the Church of Satan did adopt pagan rituals and iconography, though they claimed to not believe in the supernatural. Rather, they believed in the symbolism of the Satan whom Christianity invoked, a tale of a fallen archangel who chose his pride over God's will, who was jealous of the free will that God granted humans to enjoy in the material world, as well as the freedom to choose their own morality. LaVeyan Satanism is about choosing yourself and your own pleasures over established cultural norms. Dr. Charles Scudder, a respected professor of pharmacology and a gay man, embraced the Church of Satan. In it, he saw the freedom to live his life as he chose, without the bonds of societal judgment. He went so far as to build his own castle in the woods, named Corpsewood Manor. It was heavily decorated with pagan and occult art. It was an isolated paradise of his own. But it wasn't long before opportunistic and actual evil invaded Scudder's sanctuary. The murders of Dr. Scudder and his companion forever cemented Corpsewood Manor as a cursed and haunted place. Whether or not Satan has anything to do with this is up to you. But as they say, the devil's in the details. Happy Halloween, and welcome to Episode 32, The Corpsewood Manor Murders. The following is a direct quote from Dr. Charles Scudder. After some soul-searching conversations with Joe, I decided that we really needed to find some place in hilly country, with the glamour of four seasons, but without super cold winters, with a good supply of pure water and wood for heating and cooking, and, most important, with a measure of isolation. After years of enduring the sensory overload of city life, I desperately wanted to be situated where I could neither see nor hear my neighbors. Dr. Charles Scudder, with his partner, Joe Odom, built Corpsewood Manor with his bare hands on a secluded mountain in northwest Georgia. Charles was a practicing member of the Church of Satan, but Satanism is often misunderstood, at least the type Charles practiced. And his peaceful sanctuary was eventually deserted and plundered after he and his partner were brutally murdered there in December of 1982. Tryon, Georgia, is a small rural town in northwestern Georgia in Chattooga County. The county is named for the Chattooga River, which flows through it. Before European settlers arrived, the area was first inhabited by the Creek Native Americans and then later by the Cherokee. There were two principal Cherokee towns in Chattooga, one called Broomtown and the other was Rivertown, later renamed to Tryon. Not long after European settlers came to the area, gold was discovered in northern Georgia. In the early 1830s, the federal government forcibly relocated the Cherokee to Oklahoma and part of what became known as the Trail of Tears. The forced relocations were carried out following the passage of the Indian Removal Act of 1830, signed by Tennessee's own President Andrew Jackson. The relocated tribes and nations suffered from exposure, disease, and starvation during the forced walk to their designated reserve, known as the Death Marches, because so many died along the way. In 1987, over 2,000 miles, spreading through 9 states, became recognized as historic trails by the federal government. I'm from Middle Tennessee, and the Trail of Tears goes straight through my hometown. It's a reminder of the original sin of our forefathers and one of the most shameful times in American history. In northern Georgia, white settlers divided up the ancestral Creek and Cherokee land in what was known as the Cherokee Land Lottery of 1832. Soon, the fertile Chattooga Valley became a thriving agricultural realm of the antebellum South. A few decades later, the area would become embroiled in the Civil War with Confederate and Union camps both in the county. Many battles were fought there. The biggest one was known as the Battle of Tryon Factory. The small town of Tryon got its start in the 1840s when a cotton mill called Tryon Mills was established there. The factory opened in 1847, and in 1904, Rivertown was renamed Tryon. Tryon really is the epitome of small rural southern towns. With less than 1,700 residents, everyone knows everyone's business, and the town seems to be frozen in time. The courthouse still reigns supreme, and even the old train depot has been preserved and is a popular hangout for locals. But the most famous landmark in Tryon, Georgia, is certainly Corpsewood Manor. Erected deep in the woods, surrounded by denuded trees in the winter, Corpsewood would be creepy without its murderous and satanic history. Its owner, Dr. Charles Scudder, Charlie to his friends, was originally from Wisconsin and had been a professor of pharmacology at Loyola University from the late 60s to the mid-70s. He had studied zoology, chemistry, and languages at the University of Wisconsin. After one brief marriage when he was still in his teens, he met Bortai Bunting, daughter of British poet Basil Bunting. Charles and Bortai had 4 children named Saul, Fenris, Gideon, and Ahab. In the late 50s, his second marriage was ending, and then their son Ahab died while still in his teens. Though I've scoured several sources, I never could find how he died. But needless to say, Charles was distraught. His marriage to Bortai was over, they'd lost their youngest child, and he was changing. He was changing in many ways, or perhaps he was just becoming what he had always been. Either way, in 1959, he moved to Chicago and enrolled in Loyola's Stritch Medical School. He earned his doctorate in pharmacology in 1964. And about then, he met a man 12 years his junior named Joseph Odom. Though Charlie may not have formally come out of the closet, his relationship with Joey Odom was well known for years in Chicago. Joey technically worked as his housekeeper and cook. From all accounts, the university did not realize Charles was gay, and Joey was seen as an employee and companion to the eccentric Dr. Scudder. The late 60s and early 70s were a time of great change in America. We had made strides in the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War was finally coming to an end, and the scandal of Watergate certainly marked the end of innocence for a lot of Americans. And it wasn't just turn on, tune in, and drop out. Though that was the rallying cry for some young adults in that era. It was a seismic cultural shift, one still felt today. though in the late 60s, it was a bit different for a middle-aged gay man with a doctorate in pharmacology. Loyola University participated in the infamous MKUltra program, also known as the CIA Mind Control Program. There were experiments on humans to identify and develop drugs to be used in warfare, mainly for interrogations to force confessions through mind control. But there are whispers that the government formed MKUltra to create a real Manchurian candidate through mind control techniques. The project was organized by the Office of Scientific Intelligence of the CIA and worked closely with the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratories. Loyola's part in this was by helping to recreate LSD-25, which the CIA had bought from Sandoz Laboratories. They believed that the hallucinogenic properties of LSD could aid in mind control, as those under the influence are highly susceptible to suggestion. Historians have a hard time researching the program because in 1973, CIA Director Richard Helms ordered all records of MKUltra to be destroyed. But we do know that Dr. Charles Scudder participated in the program. He wrote several papers, one entitled The Mind, an Evolving System of Models, and another called Mindless Meaning, Meaningless Mind. But it wasn't just his background or professional journals that proved Dr. Scudder's involvement. After his death, several vials of clear liquid were found at Corpsewood Manor. The Georgia State Crime Lab analyzed the vials and found it was pure LSD-25. And they believed the vials had the same chemical signature of the original batches of the drug imported by the CIA. And though Charles's work with MKUltra would have been kept secret, he still cut a flamboyant figure at the university, dyeing his dark hair purple before he went totally blonde in later years. He kept a pet monkey and also had a pink gargoyle fountain in front of his old West Side Chicago mansion. The mansion, built in 1904, was becoming increasingly expensive to maintain, and at the same time, the neighborhood around him was crumbling. Initially, Charles reveled in the fading beauty of the old mansion and loved the space he had for his many collections. He was into antiques, art, and many macabre pieces of the occult that will make sense when we get more into his religion. He also was a voracious artist himself, painting many pieces and even designed a stained glass window with a pentagram. He and Joey lived happily in the mansion for some time, living with their two huge mastiff dogs, Beelzebub and Arsinath. Beelzebub is a demon in ancient literature and is often used as another name for the devil, and Arsinath is believed to have come from an H.P. Lovecraft character, an author who is popular with Satanists. Charles was known for his dedicated correspondence. Many of his letters can be found on the internet today, and during this time, he started corresponding with Anton LaVey. Anton LaVey established LaVeyan Satanism in California when he founded the Church of Satan in 1966. LaVey proclaimed 1966 to be Year One, or Anno Satanis, the first year of the Age of Satan. He was heavily influenced by the writings of Friedrich Nietzsche and Ayn Rand. The Church of Satan's doctrines were codified in LaVey's book, The Satanic Bible. But despite what many people believe, especially during the time of the Satanic Panic in the 80s and 90s, Satanists don't actually worship the devil or Satan or any other name given to this figure in Christianity. They do not believe that Satan literally exists. They simply see him as a symbol of pride, materialism, carnality, and enlightenment. They do reject the existence of supernatural beings or life after death. So really it is more like atheism than people believe. Atheism is a disbelief in any god or afterlife, but the Church of Satan and the term Satanist certainly invokes the idea of devil worship, no matter how much the practitioners try to explain their beliefs. Satan is a symbol in this church, usually one of defiance against Abrahamic religions. Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are the Abrahamic religions with the greatest number of believers. Satanists, particularly LaVeyan Satanists, feel that these religions actually suppress mankind's natural instincts and encourage people to believe in the irrational. Irrational, as they see it, is believing in God or other deities, as well as an afterlife, whether that be heaven or hell. Satanism preaches a naturalistic philosophy for man. They see humans as basically animals in an amoral world. They promote individualism, egoism, and even social Darwinism. They do not believe in egalitarianism, which is a philosophy that posits all humans are equal within the social order. Anthropologist Jean LaFontaine once described Levian Satanism as having, quote, both elitist and anarchist elements. Another historian of religion, Matthias Gardel, described Levians as having a rational ideology of egotistic hedonism and self-preservation. Some critics have also called it merely self-indulgence, though I don't think Satanists would find that insulting. That is indeed their point. To live their lives as they want, outside of societal norms, without judgment. LaVey and the Church of Satan feel that Satanists are born, not made. They are misfits, outsiders by nature, and they are drawn to this religion because it aligns with their own beliefs and lifestyles. So Charles was actually corresponding with the leader of the Church of Satan. One might view this as part of his evolution. Charles was becoming very disillusioned around this time. He was weary of the politics inherent in higher learning. He was growing disappointed with his students, whom he felt were not truly dedicated to their education or enlightenment, and he had become estranged from his now grown children. But perhaps the final straw was when he lost both of his parents within 6 months of each other. His mother died of natural causes, but his father died from injuries sustained during a violent mugging. Charles was weary of modern society, of watching the decay of his beloved neighborhood, and of the corruption of young people in an increasingly violent society. He had inherited $40,000 from his mother's estate and decided that he would quit his job, buy some land in a rural area, and basically get off the grid. He wanted to live his true life, to be himself, away from the judgment of his family and colleagues. He wanted to pursue his passions of art, writing, and just be an openly gay man with nothing to hide. He wanted to build a life with Joey, away from all the things that had disappointed him or hurt him over the years. I read you a quote at the top of the show about how he wanted to live off the land, in isolation and privacy. And he knew the kind of climate he wanted. Weary of brutal Chicago winters, he wanted something in the South, and he found it. He bought 40 acres of undeveloped land on a mountain in rural northwestern Georgia, in Chattooga County, in the small town of Tryon. Charlie and Joey made the drive to Georgia in January of 1977, during a legendary blizzard. After hours of driving in the snow and ice, they got lost and wound up sleeping in their Jeep. All they brought was what they could fit in the Jeep, their dogs, and a small camper. When they finally found the property the next day, they found a rotting horse carcass on the access road. They just laughed and decided to name their new driveway Dead Horse Road. When they finally got to the hilltop of their property, they saw the stark contrast of leafless trees against the wintry bleak Georgia skyline and were inspired to name their dream home Corpsewood Manor. They camped until the snow finally melted and they could get to town for supplies. There they bought some equipment to begin construction and started building their castle by hand. Neither had any sort of construction experience, though with Charles' artistry, I'm willing to bet he had a natural understanding of scale and style. Charlie also did most of the heavy work, as Joey had injured his leg in a car wreck before they made the move. But Joey did help when he could, and they began the long, arduous job of constructing their home. The curved walls came up first. It is said that curved walls ward off evil because there is no corner in which it can hide. But it also is a great barrier against the elements. Though Corpsewood never had electricity or other utilities, the home was always fairly comfortable due to the insulation of those walls. Charles had previously arranged to have a well dug on the property, and they had a hand pump to draw their own water. They created a cold storage area by burying an old refrigerator. They erected a beehive to harvest their own honey. They planted vegetable and rose gardens, fruit trees, and ground their own wheat. And they even had their own vineyard, from which Charlie made his own homemade wine. They truly meant to live off the land, and for men with no experience in this type of work, it's truly amazing what they accomplished. By that summer, they had finished the first floor and covered it and were able to move in. Up until then, they had camped in tents or slept in the Jeep or camper. Within another year, the second floor was finished and their manor was complete. Charlie was a fan of the Addams Family and playfully put a sign on a tree on Dead Horse Road that said, "Beware of the Thing." His sense of humor was evident, but also possibly seen as ominous. But Charlie was thrilled with his new home. He kept a detailed diary, and one of his passages struck me as the writings of a man who had finally found his bliss. Quote, "At 10 a.m., we had tea in the gazebo, and I designed a new chicken house that I plan to start building soon. Tonight, I may practice my harp. Or perhaps I'll just sit in the courtyard and listen to the tree frogs and whippoorwills while bats fly and the clouds drift across the full moon. The world that's around me now is fresh, quiet, and very beautiful." Charlie and Joey spent 6 happy years at their dream estate. They loved their gardens and cooking on a wood stove. They made friends with some locals and even hosted a wedding in their rose garden as Charlie played his harp on the sun deck above their gazebo. Charlie made his own wine, and friends would bring fruit to contribute. They were gracious hosts and truly enjoyed their time there. Charlie decorated the manor with many occult items: paintings, sculptures, stained glass, wood carvings, really all manner of artistic decor and furniture, all adorned with satanic iconography. He had brought his pink gargoyle from his Chicago mansion, and it had a place of honor perched above the arched entrance to Corpsewood Manor. Charlie always told friends that he had never officially joined the Church of Satan due to the membership fee, but he did introduce himself as a Satanist. However, the Church of Satan kept archival records that proved Charles Scudder did formally join the church, and a subscription to the Cloven Hoof, the Church of Satan's newsletter, was found in his desk after his death. There were also many books and other items in the home about Satanism and the occult. Joey would always insist that he was Catholic, but Charlie never minded telling people about his beliefs. He often sought to clarify misconceptions about the Church of Satan. But despite how hospitable the couple were, they didn't allow visitors in the big house. They kept their manor private, but there are numerous photos on the internet if you want to look. The chicken house Charles mentioned in his diary was not just some chicken coop. It was a 3-story structure. The ground floor did house their chicken stock, but the middle floor was used as dry goods storage and also housed an extensive pornographic library. But it was the top floor that would be the talk of the town and part of the legend for decades after. It was all one big room and it was painted pink, though it was rumored to have been painted that color only because a friend donated the paint. Charlie and Joey called it the Pink Room, but it also became known as the Pleasure Chamber. There were no chairs, but a bunch of mattresses on the floor, all with pink sheets. It was lit with candles and oil lamps, and it was rumored to have many bondage and S&M items like whips and chains on display, along with a plethora of gay pornography. However, this description only comes from the stories witnesses told, because as infamous as the Pink Room is, there are no surviving photographs of it. It's certainly possible that the tale got taller over the years, but many friends, and later their own murderers, would describe the room in the same way. There was supposedly a guest book that people had to sign, but it wasn't just a sign-in, it was a sort of diary, with names and dates and sexual preferences. This item was also lost, and is only something witnesses can testify to. But former Sheriff Gary McConnell said it absolutely existed and was turned in as evidence, though he did not know what became of it. It could be because of the rumored names in that book. A prominent local citizen with his proclivities spelled out wouldn't want that out in the open. I suppose it shouldn't come as a surprise that the goodwill towards Charlie and Joey turned into sordid rumors and innuendo. It's ironic because only people who participated in the rumor sex parties would have been able to spread those rumors and therefore the hate. But then again, self-hate is nothing new or surprising, especially in a repressed small-town community. Charlie and Joey started becoming known in the community as those homosexual devil worshippers up on the mountain. Naturally, that started to draw on all kinds of people. Whether they were experimenting themselves or going there to gawk, Corpsewood Manor was becoming the worst-kept secret in Tryon. At this time, I'm going to pause to hear a word from one of our sponsors. What would it look like if we all just listened more? Listening to audiobooks motivates us, inspires us, and even brings us closer together. Audible is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio entertainment. With the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, there's no better place to listen than Audible. Remember my interview with Dr. Peter Vronsky about his brilliant book, Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present? Well, it's now available for download on Audible. Go listen to the chilling stories of the world's worst killers today. Go to audible.com/southernfried or text southernfried to 500-500 to get started. Every month you get 3 titles of your choice, 1 audiobook of your choice, 2 Audible originals that you can't get anywhere else, and access to audio fitness and workouts created exclusively for Audible members. Audible has so many true crime books that Southern Fried listeners would love, like Redbone, The Millionaire and the Gold Digger by Rod Stodge Hill, about a scandalous Atlanta murder. Part investigative thriller and part social commentary, Redbone explores an intriguing story while giving insight into one of America's greatest and most diverse cities. So what are you waiting for? Go to audible.com/southernfried or text southernfried to 500-500 to get started. You really have nothing to lose. Your books are yours to keep with Audible. You can go back and re-listen at any time, even if you cancel your membership. And if you didn't like the audiobook you selected, you can exchange it, no questions asked. Start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/southernfried or text southernfried to 500-500. Tryon, Georgia, in Chattooga County, was not exactly a hotbed of excitement, especially for young people. Like many small southern towns, there just wasn't much to do except ride around the country road with your friends. And of course, they stumbled upon Dead Horse Road and to the infamous Devil Worshipper's Castle on the mountain. Dr. Scudder was always a pleasant host, often sharing his homemade wine, and for those so inclined, he entertained in the Pink Room. I've mentioned Charles Scudder's immense correspondence before, and nothing changed when he moved to the sticks. If anything, he became a more prolific letter writer, even writing to inmates or ex-cons. And almost all of these letters were about one thing, sex. Charlie invited people over for what was called sex and games in these letters, and the responses were extremely illicit, often with nude photos included. And at this point, you might be wondering why Charlie invited so many strangers to Corpsewood and welcomed those that dropped by. After all, he created this retreat in the hilly wilderness for privacy. Some people say he just had an innate sense of hospitality. Other, closer friends insisted that Dr. Scudder was a brilliant man who remained very curious about human behavior. He enjoyed not just participating, but watching. He encouraged people to be themselves. And though Charlie and Joey appeared to be a committed couple in a long-term relationship, that doesn't mean they remained faithful to only each other. Well, at least on Charlie's part. His voracious sexual appetite far exceeded his partner's, and friends thought he often left Joey in the background of his parties. I'm not sure this is an entirely fair way to characterize the relationship. As noted earlier, Joey had broken a leg in a serious car accident, and he had also suffered a severe head injury. He was never the same after that. Often a bit slower in responses, and sometimes, to outsiders, he seemed addled or even slow, possibly because he sustained brain damage from the accident. It seems more likely to me that Charlie remained with Joey out of love and affection, but didn't necessarily confine himself to the trappings of a traditional relationship, and that would be much in keeping with his Levian satanic beliefs. And the game part of sex and games often involved drug use. Charlie evidently was generous with his cache of LSD. It's easy to see how a pharmacologist like Charles Scudder would use the drug this way. LSD increases the signal of serotonin receptors in the brain, meaning that the user feels euphoric, especially if engaged in physical stimulation. It also decreases inhibitions, so those that might want to experiment but feel shy would be more open to participating in the sex parties. But a point that needs to be clear is that witnesses who did confirm that they used LSD provided by Charles Scudder emphatically denied that he gave it to them without their knowledge. It was always their choice, just as it was their choice to come to the Pink Room. Charlie did not push his sexual proclivities on his guests. He just made a welcoming environment for them to explore their own. He also was rumored to eschew drug use himself, though he didn't begrudge it for his visitors. Visitors later reported smoking pot, drinking, and using LSD, while Charlie often just sipped wine. Some people felt he enjoyed being around young people again. He did apply to teach at a school in Tryon, but was not hired because they claimed he was overqualified. I'm sure that wasn't the real reason, but it does seem that Charles still enjoyed his role as a teacher and wanted to continue. But to be fair, many of the witnesses also said Charlie did partake in the sex at the parties, even with teenagers. And while he didn't give the teens LSD, he did share his potent homemade wine. There are many that would consider this pedophilic behavior, and of course in many instances, it is. But there is no indication he was targeting teenagers, especially young teens. When I say teenagers took place in the sex and game parties, typically it was those that were of age to consent. The age of consent in Georgia at the time was 14, but Charlie didn't allow teens that young in the pink room. The typical teens that hung out there were 17 and older. They might not be able to legally buy booze, but they were of the age to experiment with their sexuality, which Charlie did encourage. Looking at this with 2018 eyes, it doesn't sit well, but it's worth pointing out that in the early 80s, teens 17 and older were often treated as adults. There were designated smoking areas in high schools. Liquor store owners often looked the other way and sold them booze. It was just a different era with different societal standards. And it's important to note again, Charlie and Joey invited visitors to the chicken house, more specifically the pink room, or to roam the extensive gardens and handmade gazebos, but not to the Corpsewood house proper. That remained their private space. There was a small circle of friends allowed in the big house. One included a woman named Candace Williamson, who often brought her children with her to play in the gardens of Corpsewood while she drank wine and visited with the two men. She insisted they were kind and generous men who adored her children and never acted improperly or made her feel uncomfortable. I think it's obvious that the pink room was designed to be designated for their more bacchanal parties, separate from their home. The oval structure of the home measured 44 by 16 feet, and it had a retractable drawbridge connecting the main house to the sun deck located above the gazebo entrance. Charlie and Joey liked to have tea on the sun deck, but there are also rumors that Charles kept a pagan altar up there. Proof of this was not found, but it would be in keeping with the symbolic iconography the Church of Satan incorporated into their own beliefs, as well as Charlie's personal taste in decor. The manor and even their cars were decorated with numerous pentagrams. A black and gold statue of Mephistopheles was found with many occult items on the property, including two human skulls found in Dr. Scudder's study. He had apparently taken them from the university when he left, though no one had missed them. Again, it's up to the listener or anyone who reads up on this case to believe what they want about Dr. Scudder and his beliefs. If you visit the Church of Satan website, they certainly claim him as one of their own. But I also want to remind you that their so-called devil worship was strictly symbolic. They didn't believe in Satan. They simply eschewed Christian morals and societal norms. It isn't surprising that a patron of the arts like Charles Scudder, who also had an interest in the occult and was a practicing Satanist, would adorn his home with this kind of art. That he was interested in the iconography and the beauty of symbolism is more than evident. And though he hosted parties and welcomed drop-in visitors, Charlie was a man of routine. He did like keeping his schedule. He rose at the same time every day, and cocktail hour began strictly at 5 p.m. Also, he and Joey regularly made their trip to town for supplies and to pick up their mail, precisely every 18 days. So the locals were aware of the two harmless middle-aged men. The local sheriff never found a reason to come and kick up the dirt at Corpsewood. Instead, he employed a very refreshing live-and-let-live attitude towards the gay men. Though in the early 80s, in a small southern town, homophobic attention would likely have focused on the pair, especially with their unusual home and isolation from the community. But though more conservative locals may have gossiped, the men were for the most part left in peace. That peace would soon be broken, and broken by someone who they had welcomed at their parties, that they had shared their wine with, someone who looked around and thought Dr. Charles Scudder had a lot of nice things and he must be a rich man. now I'm going to pause for a final word from our sponsors. One such visitor to Corpsewood was a 17-year-old named Kenneth Brock. Brock had led a sad life, without much education. He was abused and abandoned by his father as a young teen and was taken in by a 30-year-old man named Tony West. Tony West had quite the past himself. When he was 13 years old, he shot and killed his 2-year-old nephew after purposely pointing a gun at his head. He claimed he was playing and that it was an accident, but he was confined to a mental hospital until he was 18. And in the years since he had left, he was characterized as a bad seed by his family and was shunned and left to his own devices. He carried on a life of petty crime, and just a few years before the Corpsewood murders, he shot and killed his brother-in-law, who had escaped from jail. Though he didn't serve real time, he now had a violent felony on his record. When he met Brock, he was unemployed and spent his days drinking and grousing about the life he thought he deserved. In November of 1982, Kenneth moved into Tony West's trailer. They spent their evenings drinking beer, smoking pot, and also huffing what they called Tootaloo, a cheap way to get high by huffing paint thinner and glue poured onto a rag. Kenneth Brock had met Charles Scudder and Joey Odom when he was hunting on their property. Instead of throwing the teen off, they invited him to hang out, as they usually did with surprise visitors. He was eventually invited into the pink room and drank plenty of Charlie's wine, which he later claimed lowered his inhibitions. He said that Charles Scudder performed oral sex on him, which though he was adamant that he wasn't homosexual, he did nothing to stop it, and in fact went back many times to play in the pink room. He later claimed to be embarrassed and angry at the encounters, but he did keep returning. And he did tell his new friend, Tony West, all about the gay devil worshippers with an isolated estate in the woods. He was convinced that Charlie and Joey were sitting on an immense fortune. Kenneth Brock was a young, poor man who had struggled all his life, and here were two gay, middle-aged men with no discernible income, living in the woods with plenty of drugs and booze, as well as nice things. I guess it's easy to understand his ignorance. He didn't know that Charles had purchased the property with a small inheritance, and that the rest of that inheritance was doled out in a monthly income of $200. It may have been beyond his comprehension that the men did truly live off the land. After all, he was there for the parties. He wasn't there to see the work that went into Corpsewood Manor. He soon began regaling Tony with the riches he was sure were hidden at Corpsewood, and the two started dreaming up a plot to rob the couple of their fortune and run away to begin new lives. After they started plotting, Brock returned several times in late November, supposedly to visit, but he was really trying to scope out the layout of the big house. But as I said before, Charlie didn't allow visitors in there, and Kenneth Brock was never allowed access. On December 12, 1982, Kenneth Brock visited his mother. Though they weren't close, she often gave him spending money, and he regularly borrowed her .22 caliber rifle to go hunting. She didn't think anything of it when he asked her to borrow it. Then he and Tony West went over to Tony's sister Myra's trailer to watch football. They were hanging out with Myra's 19-year-old son, Joey LaVon Wells. And Joey Wells was there hanging out with a girl he had met for the first time that day named Teresa Hudgens. Kenneth Brock and Tony West decided to take the teenage couple with them up to Corpsewood, reasoning that the young couple would keep Charlie and Joey at ease. Brock later claimed he hoped it would deter Charlie from making any homosexual advances, but I think by this time he was merely leaning into the homophobia surrounding the case. When the foursome got there, they were welcomed by Charles Scudder, as they always had been. With friendly hospitality, Charlie took them to the pink room and served them his homemade wine. The four were still huffing paint thinner, the Tootaloo concoction they'd been using all day. Teresa and her date, Joey Wells, hung out by themselves in one corner, while Charlie entertained Tony and Kenneth in another. He didn't attempt anything. They merely were just hanging out and talking. Much has been speculated about Joey Wells' role that fateful night, as Kenneth Brock and Tony West would later claim that he helped with the planning. Joey Wells insisted he was just on a date and along for the ride as he didn't have a car. However, Teresa Hudgens would later testify that he stole items from Corpsewood Manor, seeming to show his intent. But it could also be that he was not aware and was either simply playing along so as not to anger Brock and West, or that he was just opportunistic and participated in the robbery, if not the murders. Either way, Teresa Hudgens was an innocent and had no idea what the men were planning. At some point, Kenneth Brock excused himself for a moment and left the pink room, climbing down the access ladder and going out to the car to retrieve the rifle he had brought. When he got back to the pink room, he ordered Charles Scudder to his feet. Charlie was a bit tipsy and reportedly wasn't afraid, but laughed and said, "Bang, bang." Friends of Charles Scudder later speculated that it wasn't that he was tipsy or blindsided, but that he may have sensed what was going on. They say Charlie had a gift for working through difficult situations, and that he could talk people into or out of anything. He was a persuasive and friendly man. It's possible he thought by laughing and making light, he could defuse the situation. And it did work for a little while. Kenneth laid down the rifle and sat down to chat and drink for about 20 more minutes. But when Charlie got up to see to one of the oil lamps, Kenneth grabbed him and put a knife to his throat. Still trying to de-escalate whatever was about to happen, Charlie said, "What kind of game do you want to play? I'll play your game." But Kenneth Brock threw him on one of the mattresses and started tearing up sheets. He bound his hands behind his back and kept screaming at Charlie to tell him where the money was, to which Charlie honestly answered, "I have no money here. It's all in the bank." This only enraged Kenneth, who called him a liar. According to Teresa Hudgens' testimony, she watched this go down and was quaking with fear. Once Kenneth began tying Charles up, she was sobbing out loud, saying, "Please don't hurt anyone. Just let us go." Charlie actually looked at her and asked if she was all right before he was gagged. She was shocked and said, "You better worry about yourself." At this point, Teresa and Joey Wells ran from the room and down the ladder as fast as they could. But they were followed by Tony West, who now had the gun, and ordered them back up to the room. Joey Wells managed to talk West into getting into the car and leaving Kenneth up there. They got in the car, but it wouldn't start, which Tony West took as a sign that they were supposed to finish what they had started. They all came back to the pink room, where Brock was still screaming at Charlie to show him where the money and valuables were. Through it all, Teresa and Joey Wells would later say that Charlie remained perfectly calm, still trying to control and de-escalate. All this time, Joey Odom, Charlie's partner, had been in the big house cleaning up the kitchen. It finally occurred to Brock and West that Odom might be the easier target than the venerable Dr. Scudder. Tony tossed the gun to Kenneth, who disappeared down the ladder. Tony, Charlie, Teresa, and Joey Wells heard several gunshots. Kenneth Brock came back breathless a few minutes later, saying, "I killed that man and those dogs." Kenneth Brock and Tony West then drugged Charlie, still bound and gagged, down the ladder into the kitchen, where he was forced to look at where his partner lay dying with four bullet holes in his head and one in his arm. Brock had also shot the two huge mastiffs, Beelzebub and Arsenath, who were later found in a curled-up position close to the wood stove, as if they were sleeping when they were shot. At seeing his beloved companion of 23 years lying in a pool of blood, Charles Scudder cried out through his gag. At this point, he probably knew he was going to die. Brock and West made him step over Joey Odom and dragged him through the house as they ransacked his beloved home. Earlier that day, Charles Scudder had been playing his harp and had used a battery-powered portable stereo to record himself playing and reciting the words to William Blake's "The Tiger." It was to be a gift for a friend. Brock and West accidentally hit play on the stereo, and to their horror, Charles Scudder's voice boomed out and echoed throughout the manor. It was like a scene from a scary movie. Tony West took Charlie to the library and removed his gag, still demanding money and threatening him with a soldering iron he claimed he had. Charlie kept repeating he didn't have any money there, that he and Joey paid for everything by check, and that he knew Tony West was full of shit because the place had no electricity for the soldering iron to even work. Tony walked Charles Scudder out of the library and rushed to his companion. Tony walked Charles Scudder out of the library, and he rushed to his companion Joey, lying on the kitchen floor, and sat down beside him. Tony told Charlie to stop moving, or he would be next. But then he swiftly fired the bullet into Charlie's face. Charlie reportedly kept mumbling, but clearly said the words, "I asked for this." There is much speculation as to what Charlie meant by this, but one of his friends insisted it was because he had allowed evil into his home, that his natural friendliness and hospitality had caused him to invite evil into his sanctuary. That does seem to be a fair guess, but we'll never really know what he meant, or if he was even talking sense at that point. Tony West then fired a second shot in his face, and when Charlie fell back, he shot him 3 more times in the head and shouted, "Now, by God, tell me I don't have the guts to kill somebody." Kenneth Brock and Tony West searched the house, but never found anything more than pennies and nickels, a little jewelry, and a gold-plated dagger. They either were not aware of the value of the art in the home, or thought it was too much or too big to take with them. They also missed the 3 vials of LSD that was later found in Charles's desk. Teresa did not take part in any of the ransacking of the house, though Joey Wells did go along with Brock and West. He helped them load what little loot they had found into Charlie's Jeep. Kenneth now suggested that they burn Corpsewood Manor to hide the evidence, but it was Joey Wells who pointed out that that would draw attention. They all piled in the Jeep, with Teresa and her ill-fated date, Joey Wells, taking the back, and went back to Tony West's trailer. Tony informed him that he and Kenneth would be heading for the Philippines, and would send for the young couple later. Teresa said nothing, just wanting to get out of this alive. They took Teresa and Joey Wells back to Tony's sister's trailer, and then they ran. Teresa immediately wanted to call the police, but Joey refused. He took her over to his mother so that she could drive Teresa home, and on the way, the terrified teenage girl poured out the story to Myra, Joey's mother. The mother told her she couldn't call the police, and then, instead of taking her home, took her back to the trailer and kept her there for 4 days. Teresa finally managed to call her uncle for help on December 16th, and he came to get her. Tony West and Kenneth Brock had told their families they were going to run to Florida, but instead they took the Jeep west into Alabama, then Mississippi, where they started discussing going to Mexico. At a rest stop, knowing that they needed to ditch the Jeep, they came upon a sleeping man and a Toyota. He was actually an off-duty highway patrol officer named Kirby Phelps. They put the gun in his face and ordered him out of the car and into the nearby woods. When Kirby started fighting back, Tony shot him point-blank 3 times in the head. They then ditched the Jeep and stole Phelps' Toyota, and then they fled through Louisiana, headed to Texas, on their way out of the country. Back in Tryon, a friend had dropped in on Charlie and Joey to let them know of another friend's passing, and happened on the horrific scene. Soon, Corpsewood Manor and the surrounding property was covered with Chattooga County Sheriff's deputies. Though investigators were accustomed to the smell of death, all later said that the rotting bodies of the men and dogs, along with spoiled food and the unmistakable smell of body odor, made the stench so strong that even seasoned investigators had to take breaks outside. In one of the many documentaries that came out after the murders, you can even see the thick cloud of flies that covered the property. Candace Williamson, their friend who had brought her children over, later said she had never noticed body odor or anything like that when she was there. But investigators in the coroner would report that the couple were definitely unwashed and unkempt, along with being covered in the stench of death. Charles Scudder even had a long yellowed toenail that curved out almost an inch from his toe. Maybe Candace was just being kind. And considering the eccentric men were living off the land with no running water, it's understandable that their hygiene would be lacking, at least compared to other people who didn't live that way. Once the police had removed the bodies from the house, their search began, and all of them reported being completely unnerved by items in the house. Not just the whips, chains, and pornography, but of course the satanic art, candles, and other occult items found. Most chillingly was a self-portrait of Charles Scudder they found hanging close to the entrance of Corpsewood Manor. In a prophetic and eerie manner, Charles had painted himself with a gag in his mouth and 5 bullet holes in his head. As the police were going through Corpsewood Manor, the killers had made it to Texas. Tony West still wanted to go to Mexico, but Kenneth Brock had had a change of heart. On Saturday, December 18th, while at a strip club, with the booze flowing and tempers flaring, West told Brock to get lost. And he did. Kenneth Brock hitchhiked his way all the way back to Georgia. He called his mother from a Marietta payphone, and she told him about the charges. Teresa and Joey Wells had already rolled on them, and there were warrants out for his and Tony's arrest. He begged his mother to come and get him. Before she could, the police, on a hunch, showed up at her door, and she wound up confessing. They surprised Kenneth Brock at the gas station and took him in without incident. He confessed almost immediately, even telling them about Kirby Phelps in Mississippi. Meanwhile, Tony West had gone to Oklahoma, but then surprised himself by how lonely and awful he felt. He headed back home and arrived in Chattanooga, Tennessee on Christmas Eve. He ran out of gas on Rossville Boulevard, close to the state line of Georgia, and dejected, he walked into a nearby bar called the Palomino Lounge. While there, he saw a police officer. Defeated and exhausted, he walked up to the officer and turned himself in, saying, "Go ahead and take me." The Tennessee officer ran his name but found no warrants and didn't really believe his story, but wanted to help him. He drove him to the Georgia state line and finally spoke with a Chattooga County officer who confirmed the story. Tony West willingly crossed the line between Tennessee and Georgia, turning himself in. As you can imagine, this case had already turned into a media circus. With many salacious details already leaked, prosecutors knew they needed to move quickly and prioritize the trials over everything else. The preliminary hearings were January 26th for Brock and February 3rd for West. Kenneth Brock quickly took a plea deal for his testimony against Tony West. He was offered life in prison rather than a death sentence in exchange for his guilty plea to the murders and robbery. In his allocution before the judge on February 15th, he admitted to shooting Joey Odom in the temple twice, but said he was firing through the front door. He denied shooting Charles Scudder or Kirby Phelps, and he confirmed to the court that the murders were planned out in advance. To this day, he has continually been denied parole and has maintained his story that he shot Joey Odom through the door, basically saying it was an accident, that he was only trying to scare the man but inadvertently shot him. I understand that he got life in prison, but that was with the possibility of parole, and that's harder to swallow. Because I actually think he was the mastermind of the plot. It's just that Tony West was more brutal. Tony West took his case to trial and started on February 28, 1983, moving along just as quickly as they could in the courthouse in a nearby town of Somerville, also located in Chattooga County. In late December, after his arrest, Tony West was savvy enough to know which way the media wind was blowing. His confession was brief, as he uttered only one line. He said, "All I know is they are devils and I killed them. That's the way I feel about it." There were last-minute courtroom dramatics from Kenneth Brock, who still had to answer charges on the killing of Kirby Phelps, even though he wasn't the one who pulled the trigger. He suddenly changed his mind after his attorney rushed in and reminded him of the Mississippi pending charges. So Kenneth Brock wound up pleading the fifth. And naturally, Tony West's attorneys took advantage of the victims' reputations. Not just as gay men or even drug users, but of course, Charles Scudder's Satanism to try and turn the jury in favor of their client. That the evil Satanist had supplied their client with LSD, causing him to have a psychotic break and murder him. They probably thought that in this small rural courthouse, a jury could easily be swayed by the salacious details. They should have given the jury more credit. They were out less than 2 hours before returning a guilty verdict. Like many juries do, they asked the judge if West would be eligible for parole if he got a life sentence. The judge informed them that he wouldn't answer that and that they were not allowed to consider that in their sentencing deliberations. It only took a couple more hours before the jury came back with the sentence of death. Tony West was going to the electric chair, and the date was set for less than 2 months away. There were so many legal wranglings in this case, and if you're interested, I highly suggest reading the book The Corpsewood Manors of North Georgia by Amy Petula for more extensive coverage of Tony West's trial. He got his verdict overturned and was retried, this time getting 2 consecutive life sentences. Miss Petula's book on this case is wonderful. She explores more than just Tryon, going into the entire Chattooga community and its eccentricities. She also has great insight into all of the law enforcement involved, as well as the court officers. She really immersed herself in their community and scoured every court transcript. I say this because there are so many books, blogs, and documentaries out there with so much misinformation. So many of these tend to focus on the scandalous details of the Pink Room and the gore of the murders, rather than the humanity of the victims and the real motivations of their killers. It is incredibly sad to me that a man who moved out to the remote area to get away from city life and corruption met his end this way. Being such an open man and gracious to his visitors, he opened up his home to two evil men who only wanted his supposed riches. And they killed him, his dogs, and the man he loved to get away with a ridiculous pittance of money. Charles Scudder may have been a Satanist, but I sincerely hope that I've communicated what that religion really means. It isn't the devil-worshipping, violent belief system so distorted by the satanic panic. Granted, by their own philosophy, Satanists are self-centered and live only for their hedonistic pleasure in life. But that doesn't mean that they are violent or inherently evil, at least in my opinion. It's really for you to decide how you feel about that. And as for the famous curse or haunting of Corpsewood Manor, well, to me, that also depends on how much you believe. I will tell you that during the crime scene investigation, police officers reported feeling a strange presence at Corpsewood, like they were being watched. And many people who took souvenirs from the crime scene reported being struck with horrible bad luck soon after, many to the point that they felt the objects were cursed and took them back to Corpsewood. And not just everyday citizens, but some of the lawyers in the case who had held onto items reported similar stories. And now, to this day, people who visit Corpsewood often report hearing barking dogs, shattering glass, gunshots, and the fleeting sounds of a harp. They also report seeing shadows and apparitions. And after darkness falls on Corpsewood Manor, many have claimed to see the glowing eyes of Beelzebub, one of Charlie's huge mastiff dogs, named for an ancient demon or the devil himself, staring at them from the woods. Superstition often reigns over reason, but many truly believe Corpsewood is cursed. Not by the men who died there, but by the invisible entity, angered by the disrespect of those that would seek to mock and desecrate Scudder's sanctuary, even to this day. Charles built his dream home in isolation, with curved walls to ward off evil, hoping to find some freedom from an increasingly violent society and the pressures of living a normal life. But his personal paradise and sanctuary would wind up being the place of his brutal murder and will now live on in infamy as a desolate, cursed, and haunted manor, crumbling into the Georgia woods, soon to be taken back by the land itself. I'll leave you with a quote from Charles Scudder about his decision to build Corpsewood Manor. It's a statement to encourage others to be who they really are, to embrace themselves, especially as they get older. Quote, "My message is that we older people are really free, even more so than our young folks, and because of our experiences, perhaps at least a little more wise. If we want a different, fuller, more exciting life than we're leading, one closer to this beautiful earth, we can have it. Our only chains are those in our minds. Just promise me that you'll think about it seriously for a while. After all, wouldn't you like to live in your own castle in the country?" Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Morgan Pease, who suggested today's case. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. You can also listen directly from Spreaker, my network online, or on their app. And I'm also on Stitcher, CastBox, and many other podcatchers. I also really hope you'll check out the awesome shows I previewed, The Minds of Madness and It's Haunted, What Now?, from the creator of True Crime Fan Club. Tyler from Minds of Madness and Lainey from It's Haunted have two of the best voices in the business. I'm sure you will love their shows as much as I do. If you're interested in supporting Southern Fried, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation, or you can visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open. Just go to whatamaneuver.net and click on Shop by Store, then search for Southern Fried True Crime. I have all sorts of t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing the Corpsewood Manor case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, happy Halloween, and thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.